Morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today we'll be discussing three issues of international education news that have crossed our feeds in the last 7 days. So glad you could be joining me for this 50th edition of the Midweek Roundup. Very happy that we've reached this monumental feat after almost a year now of these midweek roundups coming to you every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern. We're glad today that we'll be able to share our 50th installment of this half-hour show. To that end, I want to make sure everybody's aware of these roundups are recorded on the Facebook page for SMIE Consulting and are available immediately after each live show. So by about 1:35 or so each Wednesday afternoon, you should be able to see the recordings of these midweek roundups. Also know that these go out on podcasts on all your favorite podcast providers, whether it be Google Play, iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, whatever, Spotify. You'll be able to find this midweek roundup available, and we're really happy to see a large increase in the number of podcast listeners. So thank you again for downloading and subscribing to the podcast. Jim Crawley, thank you for jumping on board today. Hope you are well. Looking forward to chatting with everybody today. We're going to be covering three important issues, but before we get to those, certainly want to let you know where these are all coming from. In addition to the SMIE Consulting website, smieconsulting.org, we also provide another free resource to anyone who's listening, who's interested, at our SMIE Consulting subscribe page. You can subscribe to our midweek to the newsletter we send out every Monday called All the SMIE News, that's Social Media and International Ed News Fit to Share. That comes out Monday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and we pick three of the stories from that initial newsletter for this midweek roundup every week. So we're really glad you're able to be a part of that, and if you haven't already subscribed, just plop the link to the newsletter in the comments section on the Facebook page. So please feel free to go to that this week's edition of the newsletter and hit the subscribe button, and we'll hopefully get you signed up so you're getting this news fresh on Monday morning. Now, what we'll be covering today, we're going to cover three topics that you may have seen popping up in your own news feeds, certainly over the last 7 days, one of which is a new article on India. Part of my consulting work with IDP Connect involves some monthly articles I write for them, and was able to do a thorough review of India based on recent data that Hot Courses platforms have generated from international students that are using those profiles to find out information about U.S. institutions. And certainly want to make sure you're aware of that, and I'll be sharing some of the results of that. Of that article with you today, and providing a link to that article. We'll also be covering another new development. Our friends at Department of Homeland Security have been very busy this summer with a variety of different memos on different topics. We've had the CVIS fee increases. We've had a couple of other pieces that have come into play recently. And now we've seen one this past week from SCVP, published on the ICE site, that says that CPT and OPT are two different things and should not be used as alternatives for the other. And basically, what that is referring to is a number of schools, some very close friends of mine who work at institutions that have been looking to find alternatives for OPT delays, and we'll talk more about that later. Have been substituting CPT as an alternative to that. And then the final topic we'll talk about is there a new era for agents in the United States? For those of you who are aware, NACAC did a commission a few years ago to come up with a report that ended up changing their best code of best practices. And they've recently provided a new report on status of agents amongst its member institutions. So we'll talk about that a little bit as well. So thank you for joining me for this. Looking forward to chatting with you. And as you have questions, feel free to pop them into the comments section, and I'll be sure to get to that. But we'll start with India. Obviously, India is a hugely important market for U.S. Institutions, particularly those at the graduate level, and has been for a number of years. And in fact, before China became the number one source country for international students in the U.S., India had held that title for a number of years prior. But now India has been in second place for the last few years now, but it's still been on the upswing. It hasn't disappeared from the scene at all. In fact, it's been growing every year. Even as China surpassed it, India still maintained its growth over the last decade. So, what is happening there, though? Why is there concern now about India? And I've just posted the link to this latest story called Understanding Key Markets: India, How Attitudes, Preferences, and Academic Interests Are Changing. So, what's changing, actually? Well, if anyone who's recruited in India knows when they have had conversations with parents, with students, that perhaps the first, or if not first, the second thing that comes out of their mouths has to do with career prospects. What are the opportunities for jobs, not just on campus, but when they're done with o and looking for OPT opportunities and H-1B? They are perhaps the most hypersensitive market out there that I know of and have seen in my 26 years of doing international education. They're probably the most sensitive to what is happening on the post-study work opportunity front. And as you know, in the United States, the current administration has had a number of fits and starts in terms of their approach to immigration regulations, and certainly that's been hot on the minds of many, not only in the United States but abroad. And Lou, thank you for joining in. Glad to see you back again. Hope you had a productive time at International ACAC, and the cow costume is still intact. Glad to see you're still there. Now, looking at India, I know one of the things that, in addition to job prospects, that they're always looking at is, okay, what are potential changes coming up? When the Trump administration indicated that there was going to be a change in the way H-1Bs were processed, and that there would be preference given to those who had advanced degrees from U.S. institutions, as opposed to the previous cap where there were 22,000 over and above the 65,000 initial H-1B caps that were available for 22,000 set aside for U.S. degree holders. They're now looking at for changing that way. That 65,000 is a portion, giving preference in that group as well to not exclusive preference, but preference to those that have advanced degrees from U.S. institutions. And that has been, as anyone who's followed the podcast and the Midweek Roundup knows, India is by far the largest, holds the largest share, not only of OPT and STEM OPT student applications, positions now, but also H-1B. The thing is that with H-1B, the majority of the Indians that are part of that cohort are coming direct from India. They're being imported by U.S. tech firms to fill primarily entry-level jobs, coding jobs, what have you, that go through that process of getting H-1B approval. They're coming direct from India from parent companies there, or vice versa, subsidiaries in India coming to the parent company in the U.S. So that process will be changing, and that will be an advantage to Indian students who are in the U.S. getting advanced degrees and other nationalities, of course. But in India, they're particularly concerned with any future changes to those regulations. And anything like, for example, there's a lawsuit pending, and we'll have a story about this in next week's newsletter. But there's a lawsuit that has been given the green light to move forward by those that are challenging DHS's ability to operate OPT, saying that they've gone beyond their remit in terms of how OPT is being conducted. And that is likely to fail on appeal at the next level. Or when it's decided, I should say, because they've invited in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and with employers that are the ones who are employing these international students in OPT for part-time positions, or excuse me, full-time or part-time positions, depending on their status. So, what Indians see is, well, that's a potential red flag for us. If OPT goes away, and everything else can go away, our dreams are gone. So they pay particular attention to what's happening on the more so than we believe, I think, that they are, again, as I said, the most hypersensitive market when it comes to potential future changes in immigration law or work permissions, that type of thing. One market that has certainly risen dramatically in prominence over the last 2 to 3 years for Indian applicants has been Canada. And Canada has certainly, from the hot courses numbers, certainly the survey data that I've shared, they've risen from, I think, from growing from 30% to 33%, 33.7% in the last year, just in the last year alone, of Indian applicants or Indian students that are using hot courses platforms to find out information about institutions abroad. 33, a full third of all Indians are now considering Canada as as their top destination. Australia is back, way back, less than half that, in about 15, excuse me, 15.8%. They may have actually increased now that I look at the numbers for 2019. They're up to 20, 18%. So compared to us, Canada's 33%, and the UK has even jumped the US. The US fell from third to fourth. The US is now top choice of only 12.2% of Indian students using hot courses platforms to find out information about about work study options. So Canada has been the biggest beneficiary, and why? Why, as thinking about what we talked about with why how sensitive they are to changes in US policy related to admissions and work. You see the same thing. You see what's happening in Canada. Canada is has been kind of almost doors wide open in terms of their approach towards the Indian market, much more welcoming and friendly face to their government, to their immigration policy, much easier paths from study to work to citizenship, even. So this is something that I think a lot of Indians have been attracted by that, the opportunity to work. And like had happened in Australia about a decade ago, there's been huge upswings in certain countries. And we have another article in the newsletter this week that talked about what's happening in Canada with a lot of their vocational and junior colleges related to Indian student flows that have really exploded over the last couple of years there, that have been drawn into kind of a net where some bad actors on the agent side have promised jobs as part of their and places at institutions when really the students only wanted to come and work and weren't really interested in the study option, just saw that as that work opportunity, potential citizenship eventually as their path. So that's a big factor for Indian applicants, aspiring Indian applicants to institutions overseas. So certainly one to keep an eye on. But the good news is, I mentioned earlier with the changes in the H-1B cap, that would probably, I think, in the coming year or two, provide a kind of an upswing in the graduate market again, because that certainly is where the Indian applicants to the United States, which for the first time, in the most recent Cvis by the numbers data. First time in over a decade, or longer than a decade actually, that there's been a decrease overall in Indian students in the United States. There was an 8% drop from August this past year to March 2019 in the Cvis by the numbers. That's the real-time numbers of students in country in various statuses, where the lion's share of students who are from India in the United States, the lion's share has been at the master's level and doctoral level, where combined, as of last fall, there were about 197,000 that were either pursuing their degrees or on OPT, and majority of those are likely on OPT, and those numbers have been what have kind of buoyed the overall U.S. international student numbers. But the master's numbers dropped off almost 20,000, and that's where the biggest significant drop. That's a drop of 10%, 10.5% from August to March in Indian students in the United States. Those are primarily going to be a combination of new Indian students coming in, drop there, but also on the back end of students that were on OPT or STEM OPT and have finished that cycle of their work permission and are no longer in the mix. That's the downside, but that H-1B change in terms of the way those are allocated perhaps can be a turning point in restarting interest in master's and doctoral programs. But there are visa issues that we really don't see a lot of details and reports on other than anecdotal from the field by how students are actually getting are increasingly infected by visa denials, particularly those that are coming for ESL programs, which are as part of their either conditional admissions or direct for ESL. That's where I think you're seeing a lot of challenges. The one positive in terms of critical masses of students has been on the undergraduate side. It's been a slowly growing part of the Indian student population in the United States. They grew between August and March. They grew 4.4% in bachelor's degree students in over about 1,000 students in the last year, 1,000 more Indians coming for undergraduate studies than the year before. So that's positive news. So that's one thing to potentially see. And that's maybe the results of a number of companies that have been doing tours, recruitment tours that have focused on the undergraduate market or by visiting Indian high schools for the last 4 to 5 years. So encouraging to see that continue to grow, and maybe that's a starting point for where to grow. What else is important to know about the Indian market? And we'll finish up with this quickly. What they're doing is this is for students that are using the Hot Courses platforms to find out about institutions. The average profile of those students is about almost 60% are female. That's increasingly female. They are still overwhelmingly graduate focused and are looking actually at if you're on Hot Courses, if your institution's on Hot Courses, they're increasingly looking at your information from a mobile device. So obviously the Hot Courses platforms are maximized for mobile optimization in terms of how your information is viewed, but know that that's an important piece of the puzzle. They're looking at you from mobile devices, with over 61% doing that. What they're wanting to study, again, about 14% are looking at undergrad, 86% at postgraduate studies. Health and medicine, applied and pure sciences represent about 38%, followed by engineering at 16%, computer science and IT. So those top four, obviously all STEM programs. It's a heavy focus for Indian market, but after that, business jumps in at a little less than 10%. But you do see increases in other subjects like creative art and design is actually right after business at about 6%. So there's positives to find there. Do check out the article that kind of goes a little bit more in depth to that. And hopefully you'll find out some nuggets that can potentially help you improve what you're doing on the institutional side as it relates to India. Next up, we've got the recent SEVP memo that was profiled on the ICE site. I put the link to that up on the comments section. And this relates to, as a reminder, friendly reminder from your neighborhood SEVP and DHS and ICE friends, that U.S. schools, that as a reminder that CPT, curricular practical training, is not the same as OPT and cannot be used interchangeably. For those that aren't knee deep in the current international students, advising and processing curricular practical training, if it is an integral part of the experience at institutions where it's a required part of the degree program, that's the way it's defined, I think, by SEVP. They would probably want to take a very strict interpretation there, meaning it has some sort of as a course that a student has to take, or it's spelled out in the course catalog that you have to do an internship for a degree program. Then students can do as much CPT as they want, because the control of it is authorized by the DSO at the individual institution, if the student who has a job offer for an internship or work experience. That can be for 3 months, it can be for 3 years over the course of a degree. It depends on, it could be more than that if the student doesn't want to have any OPT, because that is the one restriction. If a student does more than 12 months of CPT, they no longer have any OPT available at that degree level. They might, if they start a new degree level, they might have that OPT available. But if per degree level, if you do more than 12 months of CPT, you no longer have OPT available. Even if you go one day over, you would lose potentially up to 3 years of OPT time if you were in a STEM field. You would lose that. So when the control is with the individual institution, then there's a real freedom that institutions have to kind of play around with that. And there's been some significant abuses out there that have come hit the press in the last few years. And many who know the Visa Mill stories from California, from Farmington, from University of North New Jersey, those the stings on the latter two, but also the Visa Mills that were in operation, would use the CPT loophole to allow students to come in right away and start work, and then have virtual classes and really not even in some cases in the Visa Mills not even attend classes, but pay their tuition fees, obviously. So that is a real significant piece of the puzzle here for these students that would be coming in on CPT. So that's how CPT has been abused in the past by institutions that were either sting operations or fraudulent to begin with, to get students in the door, let them work right away. But here, the institutions that are being, and SEVP has said that they've noticed an uptick in the amount of schools that are approving CPT. Why is that happening? Because OPT is basically broken down. The processing times at USCIS have expanded from what had become the norm of about 3 months to process an OPT request to up to 120 days now is now the average for processing time for OPT. So, which basically means unless a student has a job where the employer is able to wait beyond that initial 90 days, when they thought the student might be getting their OPT authorization with their EAD cards, they now have, unless that have a flexible employer that will let them wait that extra 30 days, a whole month more, before the student can legally start work, students are losing their jobs, particularly those that are finishing their degrees and are applying for their OPT time. They're in some significant trouble. Those that are maybe looking to fill a summer piece, this is where I think schools have been really turning to a number of schools I know, some very prominent schools on the East Coast have decided that, hey, we're here for our students. And right now our students are not being given access to benefits that they are legally entitled to as part of their status because of the processing time delays. It's making them lose jobs. It's forcing them to not be able to potentially leave home, leave the United States and not be able to return because they have nothing to come back to. So institutions are doing whatever they can for their students, and I get that completely, that they are now looking at ways to use CPT to allow a student to have a worker who has a job offer to work for that period of time up until the time that they can maybe get an OPT authorization. So it's really, and potentially, I wouldn't say fudging because I think it's the right, if it's an integral that they have this experience in order to be able to continue their work experience and get a job after graduation, this is if CPT is denied to them and OPT is not an option because of processing times, that's something we really need to take a hard look at. And I certainly do not agree with the policy that I think it's a friendly reminder here. It's not going to be cutting them off, but it certainly is reminding the memo, at least, as you see in the comments section, is a reminder to institutions, hey, this is what CPT is actually for, that it must be directly related to the student's major area of study, an integral part of the student's established curriculum, and must occur before students, before the end date on their form I-20. So if they're graduating in May, they can't be doing, unless they get an extension, on their I-20 for their degree, they can't do CPT after that end date, program end date on their I-20s. So there's a lot of interesting ways that institutions are going around this. So we'll be keeping our eyes on that one for sure. If you heard my discussion on this on the CPT side of it, we talked about how In the past, this had been abused widely because of agents who and that worked for Visa Mills would bring all these students in, promise them jobs for CPT. And that bad agent piece, that's been around for years in the United States. And this leads nicely into the third topic we're covering today, and that's is there a new era for agents in the United States? And this that phrase is coming from Karen Fisher in her Latitudes newsletter, e-newsletter edition that comes out Mondays as well. It's a question that she raised: is there a new age or era for agents in the U.S.? And in her piece, in her newsletter last week, it raised the issues of because of this new there was a new NACAC report, I should say, that looked at survey results from their members on the use of paid agents, commission-based agents by institutions, was up from 30% in 2010 before they started their evaluation process and created the commission in 2011, from 30% in 2010 who were using agents to 36% now. So not a huge jump in the last 9 years or 8 years from the time of the study. So 6% more, so a little over a third of U.S. institutions are currently using agents as part of their international student recruitment. Where Karen looks at closely is that there are another 27% that are actively considering whether to use agents, so almost another third. So while the number of institutions that are using them, there have not been, even with NACAC's not embrace, but certainly non-refusal to endorse agents, I should say their allowance of use of agents as long as they are monitored and established protocols and regulations and that type of thing. The challenge really is, are agents a legitimate part of institutional recruitment strategies? And certainly there's a lot that's been done in the last decade or so to address the issues of agent standards. AIRC has been a part of that process that is fighting, obviously, is at least in U.S. organizations, is the only one doing that. ICEF internationally has done agent training workshops for years. There are policies that they have of membership to that, but AIRC is really only accessible for really the big shops, bigger agent shops, because they charge $10,000 to be assessed as an agent, where they have someone come out, an agency. So the small, very legitimate, ethical mom and pop shop agencies that could maybe just deal with a select clientele are really not able to get into that AIRC mix. So at least in the way the structures are currently set up. But other countries we know have been using agents for years. Australia, obviously, where agents really started as a thing back in the late 80s, has been and has actually government regulations that impact that. So it's interesting to see where this goes. And I really encourage you all to check out the actual NACAC report. I'm posting the link to that now as well. And that does have some of the data that we just mentioned as well, but it does look at some of the kinds of institutions that are more likely to be using agents. And that you see, certainly the more selective institutions are probably less likely. So for institutions that select or accept less than 50% of applicants, of those that responded to the survey, less than 8% were using agents. Whereas if your institution accepted 50 to 70%, 35% of you were using agents, and more than 70% represented almost half of you would be using agents who responded to the survey. So that has a lot to do with it. So the less selective you are, the more likely it is your institution would be using agents. And the pieces on what do you have as part of your agent policies, either before you select somebody, do you require recommendations? Do you require contracts? Do you do training and in-person training? Do you assess the students that are recruited by agencies on a probationary period? So there's a lot of things that I think are important there. And the NACAC study actually also includes some really enlightening information on private schools and public schools that enroll international students as well. So definitely worth a look, and there's some great data in there that will help hopefully inform your international ed strategies. What I would say is there's a lot more to come on this. I think certainly there's been a lot of changes over the last year with Education USA as a network now opening doors for to work with agents that represent particular universities. There's been fairs in India that agents are who represent universities are allowed to attend. How that shapes out in other countries will be TBD, but certainly a lot to keep our eyes on as we move forward. So I want to say thank you again to all of you who have joined me for this episode of Midweek Roundup. Please thank you again to those who are podcasting this or watching the recordings on either the Facebook page or our YouTube channel. Really grateful that you're part of our network here, and looking forward to catching up with each of you in the weeks and months to come. Have a wonderful day.